Keith D. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Most important thing that I can say tonight is that I have not taken a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any kind of narcotics since May 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. Glad to be here, glad to be sober. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in your program here. It's always a privilege to participate in my own recovery. I want to thank my beautiful wife. We've been together 45 years. We're celebrating our anniversary here. And I want to thank my friends from my home group for driving me up here and supporting me. I can only lie three times a day. And the guys from my home group go with me to see if I'm going to. I've saved up a couple of days. So I can do about nine tonight. And they're counting. That's why they're here. Phil is a gas man. He used to be Bill the cop. But they found out he suffered some mental things because he kept giving IUDs instead of DUIs.
See, I told you.
I want to thank my friend Pat Y for coming and listening to me tonight. She was supposed to be the speaker, and we talked it over, and our stories are really pretty much the same, except I've never had a pap smear. So if you want to hear her, she'll be talking here next Thursday at 8 o'clock. Or it's next year. She'll be the first speaker next year because she didn't get to do it this year or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, Buckley did all that. I got to give him credit for it. I just feel good about being sober. I feel good about being alive. I'm over 31 years sober. I'm over 67 years old, and I don't have resentments anymore because I can't remember them. And you get that on tape, Al? Al, I know Al the taper. I was in a meeting with him last Thursday, and he showed me a blank CD. He'd already printed a CD of tonight's tape, and he walked up and handed it to me. It was blank, and I said, "That's the best talk I've ever given." And anyway, if you're new or relatively new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel good about my sobriety. I came here to turn it on. I didn't come here to turn it off. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to sit around and have a depression. I give depressions. I don't have them. I love life. I love everything there is about sobriety, and I didn't come here that way. Matter of fact, my sobriety is worse than a lot of people's drunkologues, but you know, that I had to live it, and I'm grateful I did. Oh, there's Al. I talked about it. Did you hear me? I said your name. Yeah. Oh, you came in to wave me. Yeah. Did you just now turn the tape on? No. Okay. He probably bleeped that. But anyway, I'm glad to be sober, and you know, everybody that knows me is glad I'm sober. My friends, my enemies, my neighbors, the cops, everybody, they're glad I'm sober, And I'm glad I'm sober. You know, it's just good to be sober. I wasn't always that way, but today I'm glad I'm sober. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I come from a long line of alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. And that's about as long. I didn't want to check it out anymore. That's enough. And I don't tell you that any kind of braggadero, but if you're a budding alcoholic, if you grow up in an alcoholic home, it's a pretty good place to start. You have alcohol there, and it's readily available. But the one thing that I mention it for is because all the character defects of all the other alcoholics in my family rolled downhill, and so by the time I got it, I was the family's best worst example. I really was. I was the one they compared. You know, if you drink like him, you're probably an alcoholic. You know, they weren't alcoholics. But my dad finally sobered up when he was 62 years old. He was a lawyer, so he was too smart to sober up. And he was 62 years old when he finally got sober and stayed sober. And I had 14 months of seniority on him, and I never let him forget it. I always wanted to one-up my dad, and and I had to come to AA and do it. And he died 89 years old with 27 years of sobriety, and I'm grateful for that. This program put a family back together. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a wife and a daughter and a dog and a cat, and we all suffered from alcoholism. I grew up in the Midwest, Texas, Oklahoma, Panhandle, where the men are men and the sheep are unscared. No man's land. The Baptists bought all the liquor license, so we drank homebrew and white lightning and moonshine. And I guarantee you, the only thing that there was no umbrellas or little cherries or olives floating in that stuff. A couple of dead flies and yeah. We used to drink purple passion and made it in a 5-gallon pickle crock, and you'd fill it halfway full of white lightning, and then you put a gallon or so of Mogan David wine in on top of it, and then a quart of Everclear, and fill it up with Welch's grape juice, and you used a metal ladle, I guarantee, and you drank that stuff in metal cups, and you could hear sound and see color, I guarantee you, when you did that. A couple of cups of that stuff, and you could hear color and see sound, I guarantee you. I lived in a two-story apartment. A guy came and drank 3 cups of that and walked out and took the first step and fell all the way to the bottom, got up and brushed himself off and walked away. One guy came over, he was restoring a piano, and he drank 3 or 4 cups of purple passion, went over and took a hammer and sledgehammer and beat that piano clear into the ground. He had all kinds of things happen. But that guy would see me coming down the street, he'd go clear on the other side of the street. He wouldn't even come around me. It really it released all your inhibitions and allowed you to be able to express yourself. And I grew up. And when I was 12 years old, I grew up in a farming community. When I was 12 years old, I could drive a car. I got a farm permit, I could drive a car. I'd sit on a pillow. And immediately I got in trouble, and they locked me up as a result of drunken driving and bodily injury, leaving the scene of an accident. No big deal, it just happened. And they locked me up, and I spent from the time I was 12 and a half years old till the time I was 16 and a half years old, incarcerated in a junior reformatory type thing. And I didn't drink in there. We couldn't drink in there, but we sniffed all the, when the nurse would come in her car, well, we'd sniff the gas, and we'd take airplane glue and put it in the bottom of a paper bag and put it over our head. I didn't know that was a dope fiend, I would hope to die dope fiend. They just said, don't let your nose hit the bottom of the bag or you'll be wearing that baby for a week, They had those inhalers that had Benzedrine and Dexedrine, and everything. You chop that cotton and swallow it, and then you had to throw it up within about 30 minutes or that cotton would swell up and constipate you for a month. The consequences of that. And I was locked up in about a 10 by 10 room with 2 other guys and a vibrator and a magazine, and I'd take a bunch of that Benzedrine so I could stay awake and not miss my turn with the magazine, I didn't have any trouble with the second step when I got here, One little girl came up to the fence on the outside and with a guy in a suit, and they asked me if I'd sign these papers, and she'd come back later and give me favors, and I did. And she never showed up, but she got to stay in America. I thought about her a lot, but that must have been the beginning of my abandonment issues. I didn't realize that. I got out of there when I was 16 years old, and my grandma told me it doesn't take any more effort to marry a rich woman than it does to marry a poor woman. So I met this little gal, and her daddy's one of the 10 richest men in the United States, and I sweet-talked her, and we got married in Galveston, Texas, and 9 months later, well, they annulled me, and I continued on with some more of my abandonment issues. I was in a Fort Worth jail for driving a car that had some outside issues in the trunk, my father-in-law come to see me, and he said, I got a lot of money. I said, I know that, and he said, the reason I have a lot of money is because I don't make bad investments, and you're a bad investment. As a result of that, I got to do almost 2 years down in Huntsville and learn some things. I don't know much, but it don't make any difference whether you're pitching or catching. You're still playing ball. I found that out. But I got out of there and I got $100 and a new suit, and I bought a bottle of whiskey, and I got on a train in South Texas and headed up, called my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and they were waiting in Amarillo in an old pickup truck. They'd been listening to Wolfman Jack for a couple of days out there and run the battery down, drinking moonshine, and had a jar full of bennies. And I did my first four-step, and I look back on my life. I got to stay out of them honky-tonks, stay away from them sick women. You can put 10 women against the wall, and I'll get the sickest one out of the bunch every time. It's just like a magnet. Yeah, there's some in here tonight, I can feel them. They're ready. You know, they're ready. They don't need to pack, man. They got the buzz, you know. And I wrote that down, you know, in my mind. And I got to stay out of the way from them guys and stay out of them fast cars. And I got drunk and got off the train there in Amarillo, Texas. And we got a push start. And I started doing my first fifth step with Oily and Goose. And I told them, man, I need to stay away from you guys. And they said, yeah, you do. You really do. You're trouble. So I need to stay, you know, I need to stay out of them honky-tonk bars and stay out of them fights. Yeah, we do. At midnight, we rolled into a dance down on Wolf Creek. Now, the cops didn't even come to Wolf Creek. And Wolf Creek, they had a band, and at midnight, the band took an intermission on stage, and everybody left, and all the hairy-legged old boys lined up against the wall. And I walked in the back door, rolled a Coke bottle down, bumped the stage, and let the meanest sucker in the house bring it here. I'm home. And it looked like a stampede coming my direction. And I punched the first guy leading the charge because they're usually the drunkest. Now, I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. I start a fight like that, I'm not going to stay around. And I ducked into the woman's restroom. As I ducked into the woman's restroom, there's a lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And she said, okay, and I ran into the woman's restroom. That was 47 years ago, and that was that lady sitting on. I found out later she finished the fight I started. We dated for 2 weeks, and they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. We used to beat the hell out of each other and call it foreplay. There wasn't any passion unless there was somebody bleeding, you know. Terrible, terrible. It was so insane it had to be love. It was just absolutely so much pain involved that it just had to be love. And we went together for a couple of years, didn't want to rush into anything. And she said she was pregnant and said I was the father. I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when we had that discussion. But push the car around the block. If you don't miscarry, I'll marry you. And she was tough. And so I'm not putting you down. That's the way I thought. My friends told me that's what you do, you know. And so she was healthy. And all of a sudden, we're married. We got married in Amarillo, Texas. In a preacher's kitchen, he's drunk. His wife was peeling onions in the kitchen. Everybody's crying. And it was really, I stiffed the guy for $30. I started off wrong. I was just all wrong. But anyway, we set out for a life of happy destiny. And I took her on that road of an alcoholic, and I took her all over. Unbelievable. I eventually had a friend named Lion Shorty, and I told Shorty, I got to get out of town. And he said, I can make a phone call and get you a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. Guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? I mean, I didn't know that was ocean. What the heck? Oh, ye of little faith. And I loaded up everything in the old station wagon, got her and the kid and the dog and the cat, and an old trailer behind looked like the grapes of wrath, and we took off from Oklahoma City. I went by a buddy of mine, had a girlfriend, worked in a pharmacy, and I ran through there with a baggie and filled it full of everything. I'd go a couple of days, and I'd sleep a couple of days, and I'd go a couple of days, and I'd stay up for a couple of days. Took us 30 days to get from Oklahoma City to L.A. She asked me one time, why don't you pull in and ask somebody where we are? And I said, I don't want to do that. Then they'll know I'm lost. I stopped in Arizona in a petrified forest and looked at some dog poop for about 3 days. Guy said, that's dog poop. I said, man, I thought it was wood that had been here for a long time. Whatever it is, been here a long time. I took some animal tranquilizers and I kind of got the smalls. Yeah. I don't know about you. If you're a specialist here tonight, that's fine. I don't look down on it. I mean, there's stories in the big book to fit everybody. You know, I'm a pig myself. I'd do anything, anytime. I'd stick a horse turd in my right ear if I thought I'd get a fix off of it, and some people said I did that. But I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something that I smoke a little weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. Then I'd shoot a little speed so I'd have the strength to do it, snort a little coke so I could be cool when I did it, and then drink a little whiskey and forget what the heck it was I was going to do, man. I don't specialize, man. I move right on to the next thing, man. I got to California and moved into a house nobody lived in for a while. I got a deal on it. And a bunch of hippies next door. I never seen no hippies down in Texas where I come from. This is in the 60s and some flower children over there. They take all their clothes off and drop some acid and lay in the front yard naked and watch the sun come on and go down. I had to leave Oily and Goose back in Texas, so I made some friends next door. Met Doc and Professor over there. They had some strange stuff. And, I dropped some acid and went to see 2001. And they said, be careful, you'll have a bad trip. It wasn't a good trip unless I had a bad trip. What are you talking about? Went to San Francisco, saw some flowers, and wandered around aimlessly. But I'm one of them guys that always brings people home with me. You know, the guys that don't want to go home and fight with their wife, they always come home with me and watch me fight with mine. You know? My wife took up carrying this butcher knife. She's always carrying this butcher knife, waving this butcher knife around. I came home one time and she wanted to talk to me and I passed out on her 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. They don't like that. Passed out on my stomach. She stabbed me all over my back. I mean, I may be sick, I ain't stupid, I never sharpened no knives. But she stabbed me through my shirt, all through my shirt, and I come to the next morning and said, geez, something's wrong with my back. And she said, oh, let me see. Peeled my shirt off, and she said, you broke out of acne in the back, drinking all that rock gum whiskey. She said, let me get the rubbing alcohol, and I'll pour it on you. And she did, man. Oh, gee, that got me closer to Jesus than anything the Baptists ever did. She loved every ooh and ah. She'd take that butcher knife and stick it in my stomach. Now, I like guns myself. I'm a gun runner. I got a gun, your ass better run. I like guns with big barrels. I'd stick that .44 mag right on the end of her nose, and she'd stick her knife right in my stomach, and I said, I'm going to shoot you. She said, I'm going to stab you. I said, wait a minute. If I shoot you, you're going to die. She says, I know. The bullet hit me and knocked me backwards, and the knife will go forward, and you'll die too. You know, Pre-Al-Anons don't have to practice for that. They don't need basic training. They're willing to give up their life to take a life. I said, you're crazy. And she was. She was. I'd go home and I'd have all my buddies, and it's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob. I'd open the door, and there she'd be, and she'd have that knife waving around. Them guys behind me would say, get her, get her. I'd say, step to the head of the lion, Ace. Come on up here. Get your Sarah the bleeding. I ended up in front of a judge, and the judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. He's talking to me about 3 to 5 years, and through a series of events, decided I should go to some A&A. I didn't know what A&A was. I'd been doing B&B myself. I didn't want to go to jail. I owed people money in jail, so I took A&A, and they brought this old guy in. He's going to take you to an AA meeting, so he got me, and he scooped me up and put me in his car and took me around and showed me what AA meeting. Now, let me give you this scenario. I'd been in a fight, and I was winning until this guy I was fighting with, his brother, hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench and almost tore my ear off. So they took me, I got arrested, and they took me to the hospital, to the jail ward, and they sewed my ear back on, and they put this big turban around my head, and it was all blood-soaked. I had this big blood-soaked ear muff. I had a long beard, long hair, a pair of Levi's cut off about the knee. I didn't have no shoes or socks on, no underwear, no t-shirt, had no pair of pants. I was traveling pretty light, no identification. So I'm standing in front of the judge with that blood-soaked ear muff on, and I think I'll give you 3 years in the penitentiary. And, oh, wait a minute, and we got a new deal, and maybe give you a court card or something. You can go to AA. Yeah, okay, whatever that is. They brought Ivan Miller over there, and Ivan Miller looked like he was drunk yesterday, and he was sober 22 years, one of them old guys. I'm from AA. You know, he was a machinist, and he picked up them heavy things, and his arm, and they'd fall, and his arms was as long as his legs. And his hands were all crusty and greasy, and he touched you. It felt like you some kind of prickly pines in it. And he said, "Come on." And I went and got in his old El Camino that had all kinds of stuff rolling around the back. And he drove by this church, and he said, "There's a meeting tonight at 8:30. It's over at 10. And he took me home, and he said, "I'll see you over there." So I went in and laid down, and we had an old vinyl couch. And I laid down on the vinyl couch and stuck to it. And still hemorrhaging a little bit from every opening of my body. And she come home, and she'd been to see a new lawyer, and he told her I should go to AA. So she come in and said, "You should go to AA." I said, "I knew it'd come to that. And you got a good lawyer." I didn't tell her I'd been in front of the judge and I had a court card. And I let her think it was her idea. And so at 8 o'clock, she said, "What time is the meeting?" I said, "It's 8:30 to 10. So at 8 o'clock, she come over and had this butcher. And she said, "Get up. We're going to AA." And I said, "I don't think I want to go." She said, jabbing into that butcher, and I said, "I think you do. I may be sick, but I'm not stupid." And I got up off the couch, and we go out. Now, here's my scenario. My house was painted four different colors because I lost interest easy. Every door in the house was hung just up against there because we ran through the doors all the time. No use putting them back on hinges. And we had a family wagon. Was a Pinto, kind of a baby poop brown Pinto. Went down the road crooked, had a hole in the muffler, no reverse. You had to drive through the hippies' front yard and not run over anybody and park over there. The driver's window was half down, half up, and she, that was her work car, and she had this beehive hairdo that had a can and a half of spray net in it. I lit a cigar next to her one time. She went, poof, turned blue. I had to throw my coat over. She had so much spray net in that thing. And the window was half down, so her hair always leaned. She always leaned. My kid looked like a wounded animal. She had an old coat on. She'd stuck Easter eggs down in there, and they got in the lining. And my dog had chewed all the hair off his body everywhere his mouth had reached. He looked like a laughing hyena, and his lip was up, and he had a twitch. And the cat had a permanent puff tail. The inside of the Pinto had dog and cat hair all over the windows. And we'd go out and get in the old Pinto and take off for the A&A meeting. We pulled out in front of this church had a big AA sign. We pulled up, and I looked in there, much like to see me. Everybody in there, I looked in, and I thought, if my friends see me going in here, they'll never have nothing to do with me. I'm going to tell you, coming from where we come from, that's called low-bottom snobbery. I don't give a damn what you say. When I'm in the gutter and I'm looking down on you people, that's low-bottom snobbery. And she sensed my approach avoidance and whipped that butcher knife up in my face and said, "What time's the meeting over?" I said, "I think it's over at 10. She said, "I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you." And I went right in the meeting. Went right in the meeting. I sat down in there, looked around, counted all the squares in the ceiling, all the light bulbs around. I knew who the old-timers were. They got hair growing out of their ears. Wisdom. I didn't say anything to anybody. Nobody asked me if I needed a sponsor or a book or anything. She was sitting right outside the meeting in the Pinto. That was my new sponsor. Yeah. Meeting was over. I go out there and get in the Pinto, and we drive back home. I go in the house, and I stayed in the house till next Monday night. She come in there and picked me up and peeled me off the couch and went back to the meeting. Set in a meeting, I didn't get to know anybody, didn't talk to anybody, didn't say anything to anybody. Did that for about 4 or 5 weeks or something, I don't even remember. And then she let me go by myself, and I got drunk. Got drunk because I wanted to drink. And I know looking back on there's two kind of people come to AA. People come to AA to change their consequences, and people come to AA to change themselves. And I just came to change my consequences, and my consequences changed. Ugh, there's nothing worse having a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. You know you're a loser. You know they're right. You know you're all that pitifully, incomprehensibly impossible to get honest with yourself. I'd drink to that. I'd sit and drink and think about AA. I'd go to AA meeting sober, and I'd get up at the coffee break, go get drunk, and come and sit in AA meeting. Sometimes I'd go to AA meetings drunk, and I'd drink your coffee, and I sober up in AA meeting. I came out of a blackout in AA meeting once. That's scary. I would have left, but I didn't know who brought me. But I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen and take a drink out of a bottle of vodka and look down the hallway. A little 9-year-old girl stand at the end of that hallway with her chin on her chest and her hair in her face. And she didn't run down the hallway and say, "Daddy, come play with me." She just watched me take a drink out of that bottle. And I didn't do that because I was ashamed of where we were. I drank way past shame, baby. I drank right on past that without a moment's notice. I had to have a drink. When I turned back around, she'd be gone. I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and I'm looking in the mirror. Because I move right on to the next thing and I'm putting that stuff in my arm and I'm drinking peppermint schnapps. And I'm looking at myself in that mirror and I see a reflection of a little 10-year-old girl looking through the hole in the door in the bathroom where I probably stuck my foot. And just for a second, her eyes catch mine. You know, I believe in my type of an alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. And periodically I would have picture frames of my life where I would see myself. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I didn't want to be there, but I didn't know how to not be there. And I would have those moments in time when I would see me in that mirror and putting that stuff in me, and I didn't know how to stop. I had no idea that I had a phenomenon of craving, and I'm the type of alcoholic that has a phenomenon of craving. I don't know about anybody else, but my type of an alcoholic, I have a phenomenon of craving. And I'm going to tell you, after 31 years of sobriety, the animal's in the cage and the door ain't locked. My kind of alcoholic has a phenomenon of craving. And I drank and drank and drank because that phenomenon of craving kept me drinking. And I did not know how to shut it off. I know what it's like to crawl down the hallway into my daughter's bedroom and bust her piggy bank. And a big time Charlie like me, I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters. Because I'm not going to be going to the liquor store or the connections house showing no copper. I'm going to be taking silver all the way. And on my hands and my knees separating the change out of my daughter's piggy bank. She's in the closet behind me watching me, peeking out of the closet. She couldn't go to school that day because she had a black eye or a busted lip, and I'm pretty sure I had something to do with it. And I'm a kind of alcoholic. You catch me in that pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing situation why, you know, I'm going to do something that inflicts some pain on you that overshadows the memory of what you saw me do. And being the very best father I could be many, many times, I'd let that little girl shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in my life. That's the best father I could be. And we live like that, not a day or a week or a month. We live like that for a number of years. And my family didn't know that they had choices. They did not know that they had choices. I ruled that roost with alcoholism and the terror of alcoholism and told them they had no choices as I slid down the wall of life. And many, many times, the absolute shame and degradation and the embarrassment that I caused my family, And I knew not how to stop. I did not know. I had no answers. I didn't know that this phenomenon of craving made it absolutely necessary for me to do more and more and more. The one thing about going to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't die, you got to keep going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And December 1975, I went on what I hope was my last drunk, and I got a run. And I ended up over in Taft, California. Does anybody know where Taft is? It ain't hell, but you can see it from there, right? If the world's got an asshole, it's awful close to Taft, I'll tell you that. But you can get a room over there back then in the old barracks for $50 a year. And some people gave me an opportunity to haul a carload of cocaine to San Francisco to erase a debt I had, and so I took the deal. And somewhere over there in Santa Monica, I bought a quart of whiskey, and I headed for San Francisco in this vehicle, and I drank a half a quart of whiskey. By the time I got up there about Santa Maria, and I had a good idea, I decided to steal the coke. And so I hooked a right and went over towards Taft over there, and I hid that coke, and then I drank the other half of that quart of whiskey, and I forgot where I hid the coke. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic and not an addict. And I got a room over there in the barracks for $50 a year. And that was in December of 1975. And I stayed in there till about the 6th of May, 1976. And I came back home and I ended up through a series of events where a 12-step call was made. A guy in Orange County, California, little Jack Callahan, came over to my house and made a 12-step call on me, captured me, and they took me and put me in a detox. A detox. Something I'd never had. I'd never done. They detoxed me. Nothing. I said, how about some Valium and some hard candy or something? Nothing. Eat a banana. You need potassium. Eat a banana. Put a banana in your mouth and shut up. And so they locked me up in this detox. And amazing thing, Dr. Paul Olliger was my doctor. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And he was writing his story for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that. I didn't know he was famous or anything. He was just a doctor. And he started telling me his story and this and that and the other. An amazing thing happened. I identified and I stayed in there. 52 days sober, I remember where I hid the coke. Hey! I... Spiritual awakening. I don't know what step I was on, but I went right to 9. Bam! And I made a call, and I didn't ask 4 newcomers to go with me or my sponsor or anything like that. I returned something that didn't belong to me, and the people said, don't call us, we'll call you. And I tell that story for one reason. That part in the big book where it says, your enemies will welcome you, be careful of that. Really look that over. You know? And at any rate, I got a sponsor, a guy named Rotten Ron. He drew straws, and he lost, and he was my sponsor. He said, I hate you. I said, well, that's good. I hate everybody. He said, that's good. He said, it's not necessary that you love everybody in order to stay sober. And he said, there's a couple of things you need to know. And I said, what's that? He said, you're not God. I said, I don't want to be. He said, you need to know you need to go to AA for the rest of your life, every day. All right? And you need to know that I'm your sponsor. I said, what's that, a friend? And he said, no, if you want a friend, get a dog. And he came and got me in this old van. It had a bunch of plastic crates in the back. Got me and 3 or 4 newcomers and threw me in the back of this old van and took off down the street and out of that detox. And I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest or walking or riding a bicycle. That's crazy. I could have posed for a family portrait all by myself. I didn't know what was going on. I'll tell you this. There were 39 people in that detox. And the last day I was in that detox, they put us in a circle. And they went around the room, and God has a funny sense of humor. I was the last one to share, and you kind of took each other's inventory, and 38 people said I was going to get drunk just as soon as I hit the street. They gave me my first resentment. And I stayed sober on 1.5 years for that. And I'm the only one out of 39 that's still sober, and over half of them are dead. So this is not a popularity contest, and to hell with the vote. I didn't come here for a popularity contest or to win the vote. I got out of there, and I held on to something, a little pilot light 2 inches behind my belly button that wanted to live life more than I wanted to die. And I got an opportunity, a window of opportunity, and I grabbed a hold of it, and I held on. And I'm going to tell you something. From that day to this day now, over 31 years, I've never argued with a sponsor. I've never argued with people who wanted to give me something in Alcoholics Anonymous or teach me something. I didn't ask somebody to help me and then argue with them. I've had a lot of different people and a lot of teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've never argued one. I've never debated this thing. They told me in the very beginning, don't debate this. This is not a debating society. Do this. They gave me a matchbook. They took the matches out of it and took the paper clip out of it, and they gave me a little pencil, and they said, do your 4th step. Well, I'm more complicated than that. He said, put number 1, you're a liar. You're a cheat and a thief. I said, I'll figure the rest out. You know? And my first inventory, I did an immoral inventory. I did a fearful inventory. I went to Alaska and shared my 6th inventory with an Eskimo. He shared some stuff with me, and they do weird stuff up there on the tundra. But I laughed at it. I laughed at it. You got to laugh at it. It's too sick to be serious. And that day I went and met those people and gave them their materials back. I had to walk through a wall of fear. And I found out that day at 52 days sober that every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. And I have to walk through the walls of fear sober in order to get to the good on the other side. And I've had to walk through many walls of fear in my sobriety. And that's how I developed a relationship with God. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I went home and I knocked on the door. And she came to the door. I said, I got to go to AA every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? She said, well, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kid's going to Alateen. The dog's going to Alley Dog. And the cat's going to Alley Cat. And they released me. And I started going to meetings. I was just crazy all the time, just crazy all the time. My sponsor would come and get me, put me in the back of that van, and I'd sit on my milk crate, and he'd take off, and me and three or four other newcomers would slide to the back of the van, and then he'd hit a light, and we'd slide to the front. I remember I slid up between the captain's chairs. My sponsor and an old-timer were sitting up there, and I said, you know, I beat a guy to death with my bare hands for less than this, and he took off, and I slid to the back, and some 300-pound newcomer fell on top of me. I would have killed him, but I was crying. They'd take me to meetings, and I'd say, when am I going to have my spiritual experience? They said, go look in the mirror. You are one. I'd look in the mirror. What'd you see? I don't know. A miracle. You're a miracle. I am? Yeah, you're a miracle. You're a miracle. That's just crazy. I was standing over at the old Anaheim Alano Club, and I was standing around. I had so many guns on me, if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. I had people wanted to kill me, and I guarantee you, if I got what I deserve and you were sitting next to me, you're going to get splattered. And I'm going to tell you something. People wanted a piece of my deal, I guarantee you. I hid out in AA because the people that wanted to kill me wouldn't come there. They wouldn't. It was a good place to be because they were afraid they came over there, they'd get what we got, and they didn't want that. Yeah. And I was standing over there in that club one day just radiating hate, and this guy come walking up next to me. He's the weirdest looking guy you ever seen. He wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. Weird guy. Had a welder's hat pulled down over one ear, had long hair sticking out everywhere. I looked down and he painted his feet black like he had shoes and socks on. I said, did you do your shorts that way too? He said, yeah. He said, I don't have to do laundry. Oh. I said, what do you want? And he said, will you be my sponsor? And I thought, oh, geez. I know I've made God so mad. And I went over to my sponsor. He was standing in the corner. Rod and Ron used to stand in the corner, and he'd get newcomers. He'd bring them over there, and then he'd point at me, and he said, you keep going out and getting drunk, you're going to end up like Keith over there. I was my group's worst example. And I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy over there? He said, yeah. And I said, he just asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor says, yeah, I know. I sent him over. He said, you go over there and do exactly what he says. I went back over to that guy and I said, my sponsor says, I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He said, I want to ride in your car. I was 3 years sober. I had a new AA car. It was a Mark IV Lincoln. It had 103,000 miles on it. It had a hood along and a horse dream. Parked it right out in front of the meeting. Anybody ask you how you doing? I said, look at my car. Look at my car. That's how I'm doing. Look at my car. And I get this guy. I said, hey, you go out this door. I'll meet you out in my car. He said, no, I want to walk with you. And he grabbed me by the arm. We walked out the door. Two guys I knew standing right there in the door, and this guy said, Keith's my new sponsor. And I said, oh, man, don't tell people that. They said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. Get out in the car, and the first thing he says, hey, how about this? And he starts telling me some sick, sick crap. I mean, really sick. Then he said, did you ever do anything like that? I said, yeah, I did some stuff like that. I started telling some of my stuff. He said, dude, you're sick. We need to go to a meeting. I said, we're going to a meeting. Don't worry about it. I take him home. I said, I'll come back and get you. And I go back and get him the next day, and he looked the same. His hair sticking out everywhere. Had that welder's cap pulled down over one ear. Just look. I said, why don't you call me here? He said, I did. The hell you did. I'll be down. Get in the car. He said, how about this? And he started running some stuff out. It was so sick, I had to lie. I mean, you can't let them one-up you. Huh? I knew that. They can't let him lose respect. The next day I picked him up and he said, I know you lied to me last night. I said, how do you know that? He said, because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did. I tried it. We went to hear Chuck Chamberlain sit on the front row and Chuck talked about the big book and the carpenter man and God and everything. We get out into my Lincoln. He said, we need a miracle. I said, really? What are you talking about? He said, no, I mean, we need a sign. We need like parting of the water or a burning bush or something. Well, if I had some lighter fluid, I'd torch a hedge over here. Had a .45 automatic and glove box, got her out, run around the chamber, stuck it up next to his head, and I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to count to 10, you pray. And if I don't have a floating resentment, decide to pop a cap on your ass, you've just done step 3. And I hummed along, he hummed along. Got to 10, felt pretty good, laid the hammer down, threw it in the glove box. He jumped out of my car, ran back in that old Anaheim Alano Club, and Rat Fink called me, showed my sponsor that ring on the side of his head where I put the barrel at 45, and told my sponsor I put a 45 to his head and made him do step three. My sponsor said, yeah, I know, ain't he spiritual? Now, they don't work for everybody. If you talk to them three guys on the front row, and you'll understand. I mean, you got a serial killer, a psychopath, and just some kind of an ape up here. You know, and they don't get it any other way. Don't get it no other way. Don't get it by loving us into sobriety. No. And I got that guy, and he showed up in my front house one day, right up on the front door. I moved to a new house after I got a little sobriety. Had a concrete driveway. It had no oil on it. I went to the door, that guy's old van was parking my driveway, oil running right down my driveway. He's standing out there with a big book, paper stuck all in it. Looked like half of him, he's going to Tijuana, and the other half of him, you know, stuck right here. And I said, what do you want? And he said, I want to work the steps like you did. I'm trying to remember how I did them. I knew the first step said, we're powerless, so come on in. I knew my life's going to be unmanageable because you're going to be here for a while. You're crazy and I'm crazy, so we must be on step three. And he said, you ain't going to put that gun to my head again. I said, no. Get in the kitchen. We're going to get down on our knees. Got down on our knees in there in the kitchen. He cuddled up underneath my arm and had that tingling sensation to question my sexuality. Everybody's hugging around here, and I get that tingling sensation. I wonder who I am, where I'm going. Cat walked by and looked at us weird. He jumped up and threw a bunch of blank paper in front of me, and he said, that's my fourth step. And I said, you got to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house. He said, no, I can't read or write. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll talk and you write. And he threw me a pencil and he started talking and I started writing. And then he said, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah. I thought, you know what? He can't read or write. We invited God in here. There's a couple of things I forgot to tell anybody. I think I'll just put some of my stuff in his. I'm going to tell you something. When God sends the dumpster, put your stuff in it. Don't wait for the barge. Put it in the trash. I put some of that stuff right in there, and he jumped up and kissed me on the cheek, and we burnt that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He ran right out in the front yard, waved real big, and said, I love you. Now the neighbors know. And down the street he went. But I'm going to tell you something. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't look for something that ain't here, baby. That's the very thing that saved my soul. That day, standing in my front yard, it went from the head to the heart. And I got the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been doing it ever since. I've been doing it ever since, and some unbelievable things have happened in my life. And I'm very grateful for the fact that I've always worked with newcomers. It's the most important thing in my life. And I've always been in the trenches of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never done anything or received any pay for it or anything like that. When I was 6 months sober, I started going into penitentiaries. I lied and said I had a year. And I started going into penitentiaries. And I really like H&I work. I've been doing it for almost all my sobriety. And I've gone into penitentiaries up and down the coast and in other states and countries. And Sue and I have had a penitentiary. She has an Al-Anon panel in California Institution for Women for almost 25 years. And we've never had a dark night. I've had an AA meeting on the second Wednesday. And there's never been a dark night. We pay for the insurance and the gas in our car. And we have paid our own way to get there and get our books and carry them in. We've never gotten any money for any of that. We carry the message into the institution. And we've never had a dark night other than unless the penitentiary shut it down. And we've carried people in there to carry on our AA and our Al-Anon panel. And there's a very, very good feeling about that. It's the most raw 12-step work, I believe, that I've ever done or seen, because the people in those institutions get sober in the penitentiary, and come to the meetings in the penitentiary. And I remember when Sue went to her first Al-Anon meeting, I went with her when she had her first Al-Anon. They didn't know what Al-Anon was. And I remember she was trying to tell them what Al-Anon was, and because there's a lot of ladies in there for doing things sober. And she was able to talk to them. And there was some junkie gal sitting in the back, and they yelled back up at her, said, so, I'm a heroin addict and you're an Al-Anon, so how's that going to help me? And boy, I thought, God, if you're there, you better give my wife something to say, because I tell you what, if she don't say the right thing, we're out of here. And I remember saying that little prayer, and Sue stood up and she said, when you was out there slamming dope and doing all those things, did you have a mother and a father that loved you? Yes. Did you have brothers and sisters and children that love you? Yes. She said, well, that's who I am. And if you'll set your ass down, I'll explain to you how to forgive yourself for the things that you did to them. And maybe you can help them forgive you for how they feel about you. And I knew she got it. I knew she got it. I've gone to those penitentiaries when I had a cold and I felt like crap and have to go out to Chino where it smells like poop. And I drive out there and all my panel people didn't go or something. And I go up there and some guard wants to frisk me and have me strip. And I feel like crap. And I go in there and I get into that AA meeting and I say, you know what? I'm honest with them because I've been going in there for almost 30 years and they know me. And I said, you know what? I really don't want to be here tonight. And some little gal stands up in the back and says, you selfish, self-centered alcoholic. You realize that all month long, the only thing that I had to hold on to was to look forward to the fact that you would be here tonight and give me some hope. Bam! And it was all okay. I tell you a little story. We have a banquet there in this penitentiary every Christmas. And we've gone for many, many years, and they bring all the people, the church people and everybody in there. And as I go to this penitentiary over the years, why, I notice this one preacher man. He's from some church, and I talk to him, and I've talked to him a little bit. And I see him, and we in the waiting room there. And so a couple of years ago, it was Christmas time, and it was time for this banquet. And I got a toothache. Now, I'm an alcoholic. And when I get a toothache, I got a toothache that just makes my head want to explode. I get a toothache that's worse than anybody's toothache. I mean, it's just excruciating pain, and I don't want to go to this stupid banquet and act like everything's okay with all these Christians and people. And I just, oh, geez. I know to do it. Just take the action. So we take the action, and I get in the car, and I just, oh, geez, I can't eat. I can't do nothing. I'm going to sit and listen to all these people. And we get in this waiting room, and there's 900 people or whatever in there waiting to go into the prison for this thing. And I see this preacher man, and he's standing over there, and he comes up to me, and I said, preacher man, I've got this terrible, terrible toothache, and I've got to go in here and represent Alcoholics Anonymous, and I my head just feels like exploding. I said, preacher man, will you pray for me? Now, when I said that, I mean, I seriously wanted him to pray for me. I was praying for me. But, I thought maybe he'd whip on in there and have his little panel, and he'd be over there, and he'd say, there's a guy over there in the other room we need to pray for. He prayed on me right there. Right there, he put his hands on me. Right in that room with all these people. He says, Jesus Christ, our Savior, remove the pain from this man so they can do your work. Heal! And they whistled, and everybody left. Holy crap. That was a little more than I kind of figured on. Oh, I go back there and we go and get in the deal. And we're in there about 5, 10, 15 minutes and they start playing music and these gals, these prisoners start singing. Next thing you know, I'm singing. Everything's good. And next thing you know, I jumped up, I ran over and grabbed Sue and we're dancing. And dawned on me, I don't have no toothache. I told Sue, I don't have no toothache. Yeah, of course. I called my sponsor when I got home. I said, hey, sponsor, I went in there, I had a toothache. This preacher prayed on me in front of all these people. My toothache went away. And he said, of course. I said, hey, what do you mean? He said, well, you believe. Oh. Well, I'll tell you what. See, that's for my kind of alcoholic. That, I'll take that. Thank you very much. Thank you, God. But that it ain't over. I knew that I'm going to have to tell that preacher next time I see him that it worked. Kind of like a fourth and fifth step. I'm going to have to tell that guy next time I see him. Well, time went by, and I'm out there in that weight room. Reuben's with me, and I'm sitting over here, and I hear that guy come in. And I told Reuben, I said, it's him, ain't it? Yeah. And he walked around to me and said, how you doing? And I said, you remember that night a few months ago you prayed on me? He said, yeah. I said, it worked. He said, of course it worked. You believed in me. You believed. Of course it worked. He said, but you had to get the tooth pulled, didn't you? And I said, well, of course. And if you're new or relatively new, you need to find out what it is that you've got to do You need to find out through the steps and the principles of this program what path it is you got to walk and make a decision. I'm grateful. I don't have any special dust sprinkled on me. I'm not special. I've done what the people told me to do. I've never debated it, and I've walked that line. It's because of that I can stand out there on them streets and I can look in the eye. I crawl before no one, and I answer to my God. And I'm grateful for that. God bless and thank you.